The Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project was produced in association with the 3rd Annual Institute of African Studies Conference and Feshrift in honor of Linda Freeman, Solidarity and Shifting Patterns of Hegemony in Southern Africa, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives, which was held on March 1st and 2nd, 2018, at Carleton University. This Oral Histories Project consists of interviews with participants of the conference, including activists, aid workers, diplomats, and politicians, who volunteered to discuss their personal experiences as part of the anti-apartheid movement in Canada. The interviews were conducted by Susan Bazilli, PhD student at the University of British Columbia, and by myself, Michael Buchert, a PhD student at Carleton University. In this interview, David Gallagher sat down with Susan Bazilli to talk about his experiences working with Oxfam Canada in Southern Africa. This was recorded on February 28, 2018 at Carleton University.
So let's start just with a little bit of personal background up to sort of what brought you to an involvement with all things African.
Okay, I was a Latin Americanist. I was with CUSO and running their Latin American program. So I was involved in all of the, because it was militarization in Southern America at that time, so we were involved with all of the popular groups that were resisting the military and so on and so forth. So I was kind of used to this sort of thing. And I was living in Cuba at the time, and two events piqued my interest. Obviously, I was following what was going on, I was aware, but the first was the Carnation coup in Portugal in 75, and I thought, oh, what's that all about? And I began to read up about it. And the second was a big disclosure in Granma, the Cuban paper, of Quito Carnavale. And I thought, my God, what's going on down there? And so that really got me interested. So I started to read about it and, you know, think about it a lot more. And then when I left Cuba, there was a job opening at Oxfam.
So when did you leave Cuba?
79. So I applied for the job and I got it. And it turned out there were only two project officers at the time. One was Paul Mabley, who was involved in Latin America. And the other one was the rest of the world. So I inherited the rest of the world, as it were, Caribbean, Horn of Africa, Southern Africa.
But I was this Oxfam in Ottawa?
Yeah, Oxfam Canada in Ottawa. So I was really lucky because although I was involved in all of the kind of liberation stuff in Latin America, I didn't really know much about the African scene. But I had three key mentors who were working with Oxfam at that time: Judith Marshall, Paul Puritt, and Susan Herlich, or we used to call her Susan Horlicks. And they were my mentors about what was really going on in Southern Africa. And that was very valuable to me because I didn't really know my way around this business. And then it turned out that my project committee became Tickle-Sack. Or rather, Tickle-Sack became my project committee. So I would spend a lot of time in
Tickle-Sack being?
Toronto Committee for the Liberation of Southern Africa. And they were a very active anti-apartheid grouping in Toronto, largely led by people like John Saul. And I found that going to their meetings and listening to what they were saying really guided me in terms of what we should be doing as Oxfam in especially Southern Africa, but also in Lusophone Africa. And I spoke Spanish from my Latin American thing, so you know how it is. You go to Portuguese-speaking country, you speak Spanish, they understand you, you gradually go into Portuguese. So the language was very useful in that respect. So that's where it all started.
Okay, so that was 1979 when you first
started. 75 was the big awakening, what's really going on. And then 79, when I joined Oxfam, I was kind of thrown in the deep end. The rest of the world.
So now we're into sort of early 1980s. So what is going on in Southern Africa, and what are you doing in your role with Oxfam?
Well, I went on several trips with Judith and Paul and Susan, and they showed me the ropes. They showed me the kind of projects they were doing, and that was mainly to support two liberation movements, as refugee camps and the like. So we had an interesting moment when in Botswana, Paul had been meeting with SWAPO one day, and they said, we'd like you to see a project that you could fund, and it was called the SWAPO Veterans Chicken Co-op. So he said, sure, let's go, and off they went to see the co-op, and it was interesting, it was a good scene, and so on. He said, okay, well, we consider that, and he started writing up a report, and so on. The next day, he met with ZAPU, and they were talking about refugees and so on. We've got a project we can show you, and they took him to the same project. So it was at that point that we began to discuss, well, what are these guys, they think of us as donors only, not as comrades or anything, and so what do we do about that? How do we change that? Is it possible to change that? The fact that we're an NGO, therefore we have money. And that kind of flowed into the solidarity movement in Canada, where NGOs were considered a bit iffy. So you had solidarity groups who did really good work, like Sector Solidarity Committee and all the rest, who viewed the NGOs and the churches as somewhat suspect because we had money and we had, as John Saul says in his latest book, he talks about the soft option for the Canadian government at that time was beginning to manifest itself in the sense that there were funds available for strictly humanitarian purposes, refugees and so on. And of course the NGOs like CUSO and Oxfam said, yeah, let's go for some of that. And so groups like Sector Solidarity Committee saw that as quite suspicious. It was, and quite rightly, I think, when you reflect on it, you know, because it was tainted money in a way, considering what Canada was supporting in South Africa at the time. So this was the soft and the hard. But that later on, that manifested itself in a different way. We had, you know, the Red Tories, the Walter McLeans, and so on, and even
Flora MacDonald.
Flora, yeah, and even some of the bureaucrats like Schramm and Lucy Edwards knew they couldn't do certain things, and they knew that we could, and so they give us money and say, that's for this, but they turn a blind eye because they knew it was for that. I'll give you another example. It illustrates it a bit. I was involved in the Eritrean question, and I'd just come back from Eritrea and Ethiopia, and there was a bit of a media craziness around it because I just happened to be on the ground when the drought happened, and then there was the whole question of the liberation war and that hadn't been spoken of. And so two things happened. One, a minister from the Ethiopian government came to Canada at the invitation of External Affairs, and Lucy Edwards called me and said, I want you to challenge this guy because I can't do it. We can't do it, External Affairs, but if you come, you can. So we sat in this room and I challenged him because he was known as the butcher of Eritrea and all of that. So I challenged him on those things. So we had quite a set too, but for External Affairs, so this illustrated the kind of thing, this double thing that was going on with certain more progressive elements, if you like, within External Affairs and within the various parties, especially the Tory party. So that'll give you some idea of what we were doing in Southern Africa, where we could take this money and we could do basically what we wanted to do with it. The big crunch came when Judith Marshall went inside South Africa and she started talking to people, trade unionists, township people, women's groups, the popular movement, in other words, the UDF and all of those. And she came back and she recommended to Tickle Sack and to Oxfam, we should work inside.
This is when? Mid-80s? Before the state of emergency, 85, 86, or
it
after?
It was before. But it all continued through the state of emergency. So we thought about it and discussed it and decided that that's what we should do. Why not?
Are you still a program person within Oxfam?
Yeah. I'm still the rest of the world.
The rest of the world, okay.
And I, obviously I have quite a lot of influence because I'm the only voice, right? I'm in the field all the time, and Paul and Susan had gone on to different things. And
Paul was at the CLC by then?
He was at the CLC, and Susan, I don't know where she was, but she ended up in Angola and Cuba, and or I don't know where she is now. But she was a really good person, was Susan. Much maligned, but I thought she was really, really on the ball. Judith was with the steelworkers. So, but they were still around the tickle sack, so we were still in contact and talking to them all the time, consulting them. I eventually persuaded Oxfam that, yeah, we should do that. We should see what it's like in there and see who we can talk to. And interestingly, my gopher on the ground was Stephen Gelb. And he would, we'd stay in his flat in Joburg and plot, and he arranged meetings with this, that, and the other. So it was a very clandestine thing. And I could get in because I had a Brit passport, and so I'd get in without any problem. And so we made contact with lawyers who were funding legal aid to prisoners and the UDF folks and the township committees and
Legal Resources Center, Lawyers for Human Rights.
Yeah, those kind of groups. And
Diakonia.
Diakonia. Yeah, and so the church groups, and of course we met with all the ANC guys, internal guys who were slightly different from the Lusaka guys, and Fosatu, and all, and a lot of it was intellectuals. Progressive intellectuals at universities, right, at Wits and at Durban and Cape Town, many of whom became ministers in the first Mandela government, and Alec Irwin, for example.
Who worked with Jane Aidoo at Sattu.
Yeah, so that's the kind of thing we funded and we helped. And then the information stuff, you know, there was the guy who now works for Stats South Africa, who used to run an information thing.
Glenn Moss.
Yeah, a little bit like SIDMA, you know, that kind of thing. So we funded that kind of stuff. So it became very interesting because I came back out there and said, Jesus, lots we can fund. So that's another example of where the Canadian government would say, okay, you're funding refugees, right?
Wink, wink.
Wink, wink, nod, nod. Here's some money for that kind of stuff. And they particularly like the law stuff, the legal aid and laws for lawyers for human rights and those kinds of things. So that's what we did, and it grew and grew. But we had a lot of flack in Canada from the solidarity movement. And at these various meetings and conferences, they gave us shtick for working in there, including Dave Beer from CUSO at that time. He was adamant about, you know, you don't, that's breaking the boycott, if you like.
So who would you define as the solidarity movement at that time?
Well, the more militant was Dave Beer and his crowd, plus SACTU Solidarity Committee. I think they were the two strongest voices to say we've got to respect the boycott, and this is breaking the boycott. And we would argue with Tickle Sack in support and SIDMA in support. We would say, well, look, there's lots to do in there, and we're still funding the liberation movements. We're working with refugee camps in Morogoro in Tanzania. We're funding the ANC office in Toronto. We're still doing, and most important, the Canadian regions, because, you know, all of these big players, Tickle Sack, and they're all in Toronto and Ottawa, right, and Montreal to a degree. But out there in St. John's, Newfoundland, And in Nova Scotia and in Saskatoon and BC, that's where we had our regional offices, and they were super active on the anti-apartheid stuff. So that's where our strength lay, in the regions, not so much in Toronto or Montreal, because there was enough going on there anyway. So I think we were able to show that we were doing stuff for the liberation in the sense of the anti-apartheid movement, but that in the field, and part of it was my own personal view, that you've got to be right there in the action. You know, you can't stand back and say, oh, we'll fund this. Or, you have to be there and take the risks and talk to people. And one day I got, every day I was there, if I rented a car, I would do the round the block and have my passenger read the number plates. And one day, we, in Cape Town, boy, there's one number following us. And then we kept going and we did it again. The same number was fine. So obviously we knew that those guys were on our tail. So actually I phoned Josette Cole, who I had had an appointment with, and I said, this is what's happening.
Black Sash.
Yeah. And Surplus People's Project actually was her big thing. So I phoned her and I said, and she said, look, just be a tourist for the day. Don't worry about us. We'll be fine.
Now, how did you phone her? Because we didn't have cell phones in those days.
Maybe we went to a phone box, you know? I mean, it's great because they couldn't trace it anyway. Not that we thought of that. We weren't that far advanced. We went to a gas station or something and phoned and said, hey, what are we going to do? She said, it's all right. It's regular stuff, this. Just have a day of tourism. So we did. I was with one of our board members from Newfoundland. And we toured. We had a beautiful tour of the Cape. And they followed us all the way around. And we got to the airport to go to Durban. And I said, Ted, you better go home. I think it's over for you, because he was nervous as heck. So he flew home. And I went to Durbs to meet with Diaconia. And I thought, oh, well, while I'm on my way to Diaconia, I'll try the same trick again. And it was there again. And it was a Volkswagen surf bus with surfboards on top. And these guys in shorts and, you know, flip-flops. And they actually followed me into a shop. And so I went into Diaconia and I talked to Paddy Kearney. And I said, what's the story? He said, don't worry. You know, they're always on our case. So if they see you coming to talk to us, it makes no difference. So what should we talk about? So that was fine with him. But I didn't go and see anybody else at that time. So do you remember Helen Joseph?
Oh, of course.
Well, this whole thing started because we had a contact in Ottawa who was wanting to invite Helen Joseph to a conference in Ottawa. A housing conference, as a matter of fact. It was Habitat, and it was the Canadian branch of that in Ottawa. And I said, oh, I can make a contact there. Well, interestingly, we did arrange a meeting, and we met in the, you know, that hotel, that Sun, the Sun Hotel downtown there, in the lounge, and we're sitting there, me and my board member. And our bags are here because we're on our way to Cape Town. In sweeps Helen with her entourage. And suddenly we noticed there were all these men sitting around close. In fact, there was one right next to me, sitting there listening and making notes. And we thought, I wonder who they could be. So
we used to call them Special Branch.
Exactly. So Helen cottoned on, or her entourage cottoned on. She says, we better scarper. So they took off. And so we took off in a cab to the airport. And it was the next day when we, you know, we chose a hotel at random and rented a car at random. That's when it started. They obviously followed us. They knew we were going to Cape Town. But it was interesting. It was because of meeting with Helen Joseph, and they didn't want any of that connection with Canada. While we were running around Cape Town, I went to the Canadian mission there. And I told them, there was no one of substance there. They were in Pretoria. And I said, you know, we're getting followed. Don't worry, it's no problem. I'm sure you're just imagining it. But But I thought, I don't care, because me entering the Canadian building was enough to tell them that I was, you know, VIP, if you like. So that saved the day. So there were things like that, but the excitement of working with people, you know, when the townships blew up in 85, 86, we were in the Eastern Cape, and we were working with a bunch of medics, white medics, who were progressives, and there was a whole issue of people getting injured and going to a clinic and then getting arrested. So we thought about setting up little clinics in the townships. So we bought a whole bunch of Nike bags, filled them with bandages and various things, and had the lads walk through the barriers to get into, to bring it into town. So a house was designated, and then the doctors would sneak in. And so that was the kind of thing you could do because you're on the ground, right? So that was our case, that we can do a lot more when we're right there on the front line, taking risks. So we had decided as Oxfam that we needed to get close to the ground, and all these trips were just not enough. So I persuaded Oxfam that we needed an office there. And at that time, we thought the safest place would be Harare. So we got to Harare and we got an office going, and, you know, we worked with all sorts of groups. I got arrested there as well because I'd met with some Ndebele activists. And, you know, remember, Sitembiso Nyoni was a good guy at that time. She was, you know, with her little organization, what was it called, in Bulawayo. But she was an Ndebele nationalist, and she was, you know, they were all complaining about the massacres. And so she was an activist, and we were supporting her work in the villages and so on. And we did some work around the drought, because there was a big drought in Matabele land, and we got a shipment of food aid in through Mozambique into a school's feeding program in Bulawayo through her and so on. So that's what we were doing. And then I was taking trips into South Africa all the time, so it was easier to do it that from there. And I was driving in, actually, and working with the same groups that we had been working with. And then it became clear that we should open an office in South Africa. And so we, after 3 years in Harare, ostensibly working the South Africa program and the Namibia. I mean, we were obviously very active in Namibia. We were also active in Mozambique. You know, we were funding the green zones around Maputo, and Angola, not so much because Development Workshop was there, and we had a few relations with him. I don't know if he's still there, is he? He's a guy from Ottawa who was running some little NGO called Development Workshop in Luanda. Anyway, we found Luanda quite frightening. You know, in terms of the violence and the fights and so on, Mozambique was much easier to deal with. And so we worked a lot with the church groups and various progressive groups around essentially food production and poverty reduction and so on and so forth. We certainly weren't involved in any politics in Mozambique, although we did monitor the elections.
You weren't funding Frelimo?
No. No, I mean, they were in charge, right? And Renamo was the enemy. And, you know, we'd take these. It was funny. I got an invitation. They said, we wanted you to see this little town somewhere. I forget where it was, but it was outside of Maputo. And they said, we'll supply a plane through MAF. And we're sitting in Ottawa saying, Mozambique Air Force. Goodness, we'll be flying a MiG-21. This'll be interesting. But it was Mission Aviation Fellowship. Canadian pilots, young lads, Bible in the seat, and they had a signal when you were landing in a municipality. If the guy had his carpet out in the garden, it was safe to land. If there was no carpet, means Renamo had taken it over. So we were doing all that stuff, you know, going into those places and trying to think of things to supply them, and but not a lot. But it was all risky and adventurous, right?
And by this time, presumably the Canadian government actually knew what you, there was no more nudge, nudge, wink, wink. You actually were able to fund these programs. Or was it still...
They didn't mind in places like Mozambique.
What about South Africa, though?
But South Africa was still nudge, nudge, wink, wink, because it was pre-elections. It was coming up to that, obviously. And the UDF was pretty strong by then. The women's movement had been taken over basically by the ANC. And so we did fund them. We did. Who was the minister who recommended garlic and onions for AIDS? Remember her?
Yes.
She was the head of the women's group in Durban, because that's where we were based. And we funded her and, you know, tried to do all the good things.
Shabalala.
That's right. Crazy. Her and Mbeki. I mean, Mbeki had saved our life in Canada. Because when we were deciding to go inside and we got a lot of flack, we called Mbeki to come to Toronto, and he met with Mayor Brownstone, our chair, and they had a discussion, and then he talked to the Solidarity Movement and said, this is okay. And then we went to Lusaka to confirm it, and they said, it's okay as long as you pass the money through us. And I said, I don't know, that's not really... possible, actually, and I had to tell them that this was a nudge, nudge, wink, wink kind of money, and so if we did it that way, it wouldn't. Plus, I didn't think it was the right way to go anyway. Why would you give them the money when you were supporting the UDF, which already was showing signs that there was going to be a difference, you know? And you look at the SACTU, which was terribly inactive in South Africa. And Fosato, and then Cosato, which was very active, and that's what we were supporting. So there was a fight between those guys, but we clearly went on that side, and so did the CLC, for that matter, because Paul Purist had then moved to the CLC, although trying to deal with John Harker. Was a bit much, because he was, you know, he was very anti-communist, and he thought everybody was a terrorist. But
in those days, Paul Pirrot, I remember, was very supportive of, the CLC was very supportive of Cosatu and Jay Naidu and Alec Irwin.
Absolutely.
Came quite often to Canada,
yeah.
And met with all the trade union sectors.
They did. They were very active, and even Lula came from Brazil. You know, he was the Workers' Party at that time. So, yeah, they were doing a good job on that front, you know, getting that exposure to all unions in Canada and getting a lot of support. So that was very positive. But deep down, you know, they thought that it was a little bit, because what was the main body, world body of the trade union movement that they were involved with? But anyway, they were very anti-communist, and they were quite virulent about that, and so... Paul was able to shape CLC a little bit more to the left, if you like.
So who do you recall, what names of people within the Canadian government do you recall being through those different eras that were either supportive of sanctions and the anti-apartheid movement or the opposite when you were doing the work with Oxfam?
Well, Flora, Walter McLean, for sure. I was trying to think of the Liberal MP who was of a similar bent, and I noticed his name was in one of the workshops, and I can't remember his name, David MacDonald. People like him, and what they would do, they would show us up on the hill and bring our visitors from liberation movements and expose them to some of their, gather MPs around and so on. So that was very good, and obviously they had some influence on CEDA and external affairs in terms of this is the way we should play this one. So they were key. Bureaucrats, there were a lot of bureaucrats at that time whose names escaped me, but they were all ex-CUSO. Because pretty well CEDA was, when it started, was peopled by ex-CUSO volunteers. And I, being an ex-CUSO, we had all these connections. So I had lots of good connections in CEDA. And in fact, one of the ambassadors to Zimbabwe, name escapes me, but he said, I'm going away for a couple of days. I have to go to Ottawa, and I understand you have an Oxfam International meeting in Harare. I said, yeah. He said, bring them to dinner at the embassy. I'll put all the staff on and we'll really show them a good time. He wasn't even there, but so we had this grand festive dinner at the Canadian Embassy with all the Oxfams. So there were people who were very sympathetic to what we were doing, because at that time, to link up with what Walter talked about in Angola, while I was in Zimbabwe, you know, we did the monitoring of the elections in Namibia, because we had quite a strong program in Namibia, especially with the Kalahari Bushmen and all of that. And I remember one memorable night of sitting around a fire out in the bush, beautiful sky, with a ring of these guys sitting around, and I knew that the Xhosa had cliques, and I knew that the Shwana had cliques, and the Zulus to some extent, but these guys were all cliques, and it was quite extraordinary, just sitting there listening to this clicking sound. It was one of my memorable moments in Southern Africa. Anyway, we had quite an active program in Namibia, and then we pulled together an election monitoring team. But by then, everybody was on board. Canadian government sent the Mounties up to the border, and we were doing an independent NGO thing. But it just so happened that somebody from World Vision in Harare called me and said, "We have a delivery of grain for Angola, but we just can't do it. Do you have any means of getting it there?" Well, of course I did. So we had 10 trucks from Zimbabwe full of grain who came and parked themselves at the border. So on Independence Day, the independence of Namibia, this convoy crossed the border to Lubango to distribute food aid. And everybody and his mother was there, the Globe and Mail and all the Canadian papers, and of course Walter, he's always there. And I remember there were some other politicians and all of the care people who were essentially in charge across the border were clustered around the politicians, and the guy from the Globe and Mail said
Michael
to me,
Welby.
Yeah, he said, "Don't worry about the politicians, talk to the media. That's what's important." So that's what we did. We talked to the media, and Walter and I were on the trucks, you know, crossing the border without pith helmets. But it was quite a moment, you know, to get into. And we could see all the bridges blown and all the stuff that the South Africans had done after Kwita Carnevale when they retreated. They blew all the culverts and the bridges so that they couldn't be followed, presumably.
Walter says you called him to help you get the lorries across, and then you had to get smaller trucks because the big trucks wouldn't go through the riverbeds.
That's right,
or something.
Yeah, there were a lot of those details, but the main thing was that at the border, the media saying, "Talk to us, don't talk, forget the politician." And that Walter was a politician, but he was with us, right? He was always on board.
Michael Volpe was in Zimbabwe for the Globe and Mail, and Patrick Nagel was there for Southern News.
That's right.
During the years you were there.
It was a big spread in the Canadian papers, I recall, that moment of crossing the border on Independence Day. It was really good.
Well, I toy-toyed 27 kilometers, I think, with the biggest dance party of my life was Namibian Independence.
Is that
Ziggy
right?
Marley was there, and Lucky Dubé.
It was
a fantastic party, which is where I met Walter, actually. Walter and Barbara at Namibian Independence.
All right.
Yeah, so they were there with Stephen Lewis. And
that's right. The whole gang were there, hey?
So while we're all doing this in Africa, because that's where I was, what was actually happening in Canada with the Solidarity Movement and the different organizations?
Well, as I've said, the Oxfam's strength was in the regions, and especially Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. They were particularly strong. And also Saskatoon, and John Graham was very active in BC. But mainly in the East, and they were part of the solidarity movement in those areas, which involved the trade unions and everything else. They were very close with that. So that was our most active anti-apartheid work. I used to go to conferences in Ottawa with the gang, with the Ticklesacks and the Sector Solidarity Committee and SIDMA and all of that. And we'd talk and listen and argue and so on, but that wasn't really for us, it wasn't really where it was at. What was at was in the regions in Canada, and we were lucky to have, in those days they called it DevEd money, where we could have offices across the country and sustain them. And that was our strength. And then working inside South Africa was our other strength. So that's the way we saw it anyway. And so we would argue with these guys in the center about that, working in South Africa, but out in the regions, they loved it. And we brought lots of South Africans up, even from trade unions and township organizations and women's groups, and toured Canada with them. You remember AfroPix, Paul Weinberg and that gang? They took brilliant photographs of the struggle. And we brought them up to Canada, and they were shown in every art gallery across Canada, you know, Winnipeg and Saskatoon. And so we did a lot of that stuff. We brought people up. We had people talking to people. But the way the Roxham worked was the regions would request us, as the Southern Africa program, could we do something with them? And it was always the East that requested. The West was more concerned with Latin America, right? So it was a lot of the stuff happened in Newfoundland. And I can remember going to a conference. Well, I gave a speech about Eritrea again, not quite relevant to this, in Cornerbrook, Newfoundland. And I was supportive of the Eritreans, and I was critical of Mengistu and the Ethiopians. But they were part of the network, right? They were part of Comintern and the African Union and all of that. So suddenly I was hammered by the Communist Party of Canada in the audience, who shouted me down. So I found, wow, who would have thought, you know? So in the East, there was a lot more political activity. There was a lot more thinking and shouting and screaming about an awareness of what was going on. So not only Eritrea, but Southern Africa too. And so that's where we tended to lean our resources, i.e. bringing people up.
My motivation for bringing everyone together today really stemmed from our best case story of doing international solidarity work may be the anti-apartheid movement. We certainly don't do it now in Canada. And what lessons can we learn from that time that maybe we could use? What did we do well? What should we have done better? And how could we maybe use those lessons now?
Yeah, no, it's a tough one now. I mean, thinking of the context then, okay, we had Reagan and Thatcher, right? And we had that kind of Trudeau double talk and Mulroney double talk, i.e. in Canada supporting this thing and then pretending to support the other. So it was a fairly bad situation, but there was a gap there to do stuff. And you had strong intellectual backing like Leo Panitch and John Saul and that gang and Linda, who then were able to articulate the issues much more. And then bring in the solidarity movement and all of that. So there was space. Right now, I don't think there's any space. I see two issues that I'm personally involved in Halifax, that I see as being really critical and potential for solidarity work. One is Indigenous work, especially with the women, that so-called commission, you know, which doesn't seem to happen. But anyway, you know, we're working a lot with the Mi'kmaq community and so on. And then the Palestinian question, because that is such a parallel to apartheid that it's not funny. But what is interesting is, whereas there was a bit of space in our day to do stuff, these days you have states banning BDS movements. So you have the right wing being more aware of that potential. Remember what happened to the Black Lives Matter movement in New York and so on. They're much more aware of the potential for that kind of thing to get out of control, that they slam it down more quickly. Whereas in our time, they weren't as aware. You know, they were just happy to be making money out of mining and so on. So it's a different context, but there are issues. I think in terms of your question, I think we Well, maybe I'm just speaking from my own experience, but I think we paid much too much attention to liberation movements. And obviously, on hindsight, we were right, because they all turned out to be authoritarian assholes. But we saw those signs when Paul Puret went to the two projects, and we had to deal with the arrogance of Mugabe and various other liberation movements, and the ANC, you know, and we got to think, who are these people? I mean, what are they going to actually, you know, really liberate Southern Africa? And we got to say, in fact, we had a meeting which was top secret, which we basically said, these assholes are going to take over and become authoritarian. You know, the Zumas and all of that of that day, you know, the stuff that was going on in the camps in Angola. And then the MPLA massacring all those people, and the 5th Brigade in Matabeleland. And, you know, we began to see post-independence, some of these tendencies were being out. So the fact that we made a decision to work inside wasn't because we were suddenly aware that these weren't so great, but these were. But it just made sense to us, because that's the reason South Africa won its independence was because of the internal movement, plus the ANC and the anti-apartheid movement making the case internationally. But inside, townships ablaze. That's when, as John Saul says in his book, capital started to say, ooh, hang on, they've got 80% of the population and they're burning the townships. This isn't good, right? Whereas in Canada, it's the other way around and they don't give a shit, right, with our native people. So, you know, on hindsight, I wouldn't, I would go for popular movements rather than official liberation movements. So, you know, I wouldn't, for example, want to support Hamas as a manifestation of the Palestinian people, because, you know. So that's what we got suckered into, in a way, that the liberation movements were seen as the way to go. And plus, it was easier, right? Because it was a race thing. That's easy stuff. Black, white, you can't have that, right? And they were very good at putting the message out, right? That this was the issue, was color.
Because then we don't have to talk about class.
Yeah, we don't talk about class, and we certainly don't talk about economics, and we certainly don't talk about inequality, except inequality between whites and blacks, but not within this 80% who's living in shit and who's, you know, that kind of thing. So that was never a question, and on hindsight, we should have looked at that much more seriously. What was their platform post-independence? What was their take on? And, you know, Jay Naidu and his attempts with the RDP after independence were very positive, right? But that soon got squashed with GEAR, right? Which just said basically business as usual. So we never, and although we had supported Jay and we wanted to support that whole RDP business, and, you know, we supported the Urban Sector Network, who were involved in that, redesigning the townships and trying to do all that stuff. We supported all that stuff, but it wasn't enough. The white business types in South Africa with all of these corporations were just too powerful, and they suckered the ANC into it. And even, you know, those negotiations, remember those crazy negotiations when they were trying to figure out what to do in that big hall near the airport in Joburg? And I think Stephen was sitting at that table too. That's when they gave it away. They just gave it away because the pressure was too great and they didn't have enough popular support, if you like. And I don't know the ins and outs of that, but that's essentially where they gave it away. They gave away the economy. Once you give that away, you give everything else away, because that the economy and the way you structure it decides on your social programs and all the rest. But if you just say business as usual, we've got to do that, then it becomes, instead of slavery, it becomes indentured labor, you know, like the Brits did with slavery. They just imported all those Indians from India, paid them a dollar, therefore it wasn't slavery. So this was from slavery, white South Africans over blacks. It was then these blacks became the labor force. They still are. And even the infrastructure, I remember going there and watching the bell ring, and that was the ring for the curfew. And all black South Africans had to get on those trains and go back to Soweto, except those who had passes to work as domestics. And that was a big scramble to get on those trains. And you look at the infrastructure now, it's still the same. All trains lead to the labor force and back in. And anything going around, it's a dangerous business. You can get robbed on those things. But so the infrastructure is the same because that is the labor still out there, and they still live in shitty conditions. And you know, I've talked to the Urban Sector Network guys recently about, how's it going, guys? What's happening? And they say, are you kidding? You know, it's dreadful. It's the same. It's
black. And now we have Cyril Ramaphosa as president.
Well, I just, Hein sent this article on Facebook, which was very interesting, on saying basically it's the same. It's like crocodile in Zimbabwe, right? What are they going to do, change things? Come on, they're just going to say, look, you've served your time, you fucked up, put him in, and that's the same thing, right? And, okay, Cyril will be not as mendacious as, mendacious, is that the word, or mendacious?
Zuma-like.
As Zuma, but, and he may deal with some of the more corrupt.
Devious.
Yeah, but he at least knows the game. He's not going to get support internationally if he doesn't do this, this, and this. But he's a billionaire, and there's no, you know.
He's been trying to be president since Mandela was president.
And then Crocodile Dundee, you know, in Zimbabwe, is he going to change? Oh, come on. Are they going to recognize Matabeleland? No. So all I'm saying is that we should have paid more attention as a solidarity movement to economic and social issues within the liberation movements. Because what we found inside with the popular movements, that's exactly what they were talking about. The women's groups, the township, the UDF, that's what they were talking about. They were talking about conditions of social and economic security post-apartheid. And the ANC never talked about that stuff. And so that's a lesson learned for me, that we weren't really listening. We were just carried away by the excitement. But we were lucky in that we had Judith Marshall, God love her, who went inside and said, hey guys, we got to be here. And we were lucky in the sense that we did that in spite of all the opposition, because at least we were exposed to some of those issues and helped to fund some of those issues, even though it didn't work in the end, right? But as John Saul says, none of it worked in the end, right? All we had was, you know, white rule in Zimbabwe and you know, Portuguese colonies was no longer the thing, kind of a colonial rule. But in the end, same difference, right?
This was an interview with David Gallagher, conducted by Susan Bazilli on February 28, 2018 at Carleton University, as part of the Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project.